everyone, and welcome to Myth Matters, a bi-weekly podcast of storytelling and conversation about mythology and why it's important to our lives today. I'm your host and personal mythologist, Catherine Savela. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, you are part of this story circle. This week I want to tell you one of the oldest stories in the world, the Sumerian myth of the hero king Gilgamesh. Actually, this will be part one of the myth. We'll devote three podcasts to this story, which is one of my favorites. And like the story of Percival and the Grail, the myth of Gilgamesh involves an existential quest, a quest for meaning. This myth has also played a role in the Western quest for meaning collectively. In an article in the October 14th issue of The New Yorker titled Beyond the Waters of Death, Joan Acocello considers the hopeful expectations that were brought to this ancient text. She provides a brief synopsis of the Western discovery of the myth and the challenges it poses to archaeologists, scholars, and translators. The clay tablets bearing the poem, engraved in Sumerian cuneiform, could finally be deciphered in the mid-19th century, and this was a time of collective anxiety and existential angst, of debates and questions about belief and truth and meaning that have yet to be resolved. One catalyst for the upheaval was the publication of Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species in 1859, which fueled doubt about the historical accuracy of the Bible. According to Acocello, George Smith, who was an early translator whose work drew attention to the myth of Gilgamesh, was motivated by the search for historical evidence to support the Bible. Smith did make some very interesting discoveries, which I expect you will recognize when you hear the story, but they did not provide the proof that he sought. Acocello's article is also a review of recent books about the poem, and apparently the N.K. Sanders translation, which is the one that I know and used in my telling of the story, is one of the easiest to approach. I look forward to investigating some of the others that she mentions, and I will provide a link to Acocello's piece on the website along with the written transcript of this podcast so that you can look into them yourself. Now, a bit of background on Gilgamesh. This myth is really a series of legends and poems about Gilgamesh, the hero king of Uruk. And Uruk was a city in the kingdom of Sumer. Sumer, or Sumeria, was located in what is now Iraq. And the Sumerians were the first literate inhabitants of Mesopotamia. So this Epic of Gilgamesh is one of our oldest literary works, dating back to 2100 BCE. That's about 1500 years before Homer. And it's because it's written down that I'm saying that it's one of the oldest stories. We have lots of stories that have been told for a long time. We don't really know how long. Certainly, this story was told for quite a while before it was written down, because there's evidence that there was a king named Gilgamesh. And some of the other characters in this story probably are or were real people who lived around 2700 BCE. Sumeria is also the source of the myth of the goddess Inanna, which dates from about the same period. And Gilgamesh's story and Inanna's myths were discovered in the 19th century when a series of clay tablets that contained these stories, which were inscribed in cuneiform, were excavated at the ancient Assyrian city of Nineveh. Gilgamesh's story was originally titled either He Who Saw the Deep or Surpassing All Other Kings. And as you listen to the story, I think the meaning of those titles will become clear. Gilgamesh was renowned for his contributions to Sumerian civilization, and the tales of his exploits and accomplishments were probably known throughout the Aegean. The Greeks, for example. In fact, some people speculate that Homer knew this story and that it was one of the foundations of the Iliad. In any event, given the great age of his story, it's safe to say that Gilgamesh may be our first hero. He certainly is the first tragic hero about whom anything is known. And I think that you will recognize some of the motifs and subplots in his story. One of the most obvious of these is the reference to a great flood, which will occur in part 3 of my telling. But the events and the psychology in the life of and career of Gilgamesh as it unfolds is so familiar and so compelling that we're still telling basically this story in a myriad of form and variations 4,000 years later. Now, I don't know about you, but that kind of blows my mind. And it also gives me a marvelous feeling of continuity and a sense of the wisdom and the enduring legacy of the past. Now, I don't want to say too much at the outset about what actually happens in the story, so we're going to move on to it. I hope you enjoy it, both for its action and also as a beautiful meditation on the human condition. Gilgamesh, as you'll learn, was a semi-divine king, but his feelings and fears and the object of his final quest are common to all of us. Now, I invite you to relax, let the story take you, and as always, notice the details that grab your interest as they are clues to where this story intersects with your life today. The Myth of Gilgamesh, Part 1. Gilgamesh of Uruk was the greatest king on earth. He was two parts god and one part man. His mother was the goddess Ninsun, who was kind of a minor deity with a small temple. But nonetheless, this compelled the gods to endow him. And so from his mother, he inherited great strength, courage, beauty, and restlessness. From his father, who was likely a priest in the king's court, he inherited mortality. Gilgamesh ruled the great brick city Uruk, and he himself built the walls, which had no equal. And neither did Gilgamesh. As a result, he was prone to pick fights with his subjects, and his strength was so great that he killed many sons and left many grieving mothers and fathers, although a king should be a shepherd to his people. He did harm. He was bored, and his arrogance knew no bounds. Gilgamesh did whatever he liked for his own amusement, and that also meant that no woman was safe from his lust. Gilgamesh had an unpleasant habit of crashing weddings. He showed up at the marriage house and demanded that he be first with every bride before her husband. So although Gilgamesh was well-blessed, handsome, and wise, theoretically, with the capacity for wisdom, and strong, his people were not happy. They complained to the gods that he was too harsh and that he abused his power by sleeping with women before their husbands did. And when Anu, who was the sky god and the father of the gods, heard their laments, he pitied them. He went to Arura, the goddess of creation, and said, "You made him, Arura, and his stormy heart. You made Gilgamesh, and so you must create his equal, so that they can contend with each other, and he will leave the rest of Uruk in peace." The goddess Arura thought about this, and she conceived an image in her mind of which God Anu approved. The goddess then wet her hands with water and pinched off a piece of clay and let it fall in the wilderness, thus creating the noble wild man, Enkidu. Enkidu was a rather unusual fellow. He had a rough, powerful body, completely covered in hair. He knew nothing of men and human civilization. He was as fast as a gazelle, and he grew up with these wild animals. In fact, Enkidu ate grass, and he drank at the watering holes as they did, and he thought that he was one of them. He thought that he was an animal. The herd was his company. But there were local shepherds who brought their flocks to these same watering holes, and they caught a glimpse of him now and again. And the sight of this strange, hairy, wild man jostling their sheep filled them with fear. So word started going around that there was some strange, apparently human, being in the area. And one day a trapper who was out hunting wild beasts staked out that watering hole and met Enkidu face to face. This happened 3 days in a row. The two of them stared at each other in mutual terror. And then the trapper went home and told his father what he had seen. With a heart full of awe and a face transformed by the mystery, he said, "Father, there is a man unlike any other who comes down from the hills with the animals. He mingles with them and ranges the land, and he must be the strongest man in the world. He is tearing up all of my traps, and he helps the animals escape. But I am afraid, and I don't dare go near him. What should I do?" "Well," said his father, "you must go to Uruk and tell King Gilgamesh. No one has ever beaten him. He is as strong as a star in heaven. So go to his court and tell him about this great, strong, wild man, and ask him to loan you a woman from the Temple of Love. You take this harlot with you to the watering hole. Have her sit by that spring, stripped naked, and when he comes, have her beckon to him. He will embrace her, and then the animals will reject him, and she will be able to tame him. Let her woman's power overpower this wild man." The trapper followed his father's advice. He went to Gilgamesh, and he told him of this strange, strong man. "I'm afraid to approach him," he said. And Gilgamesh immediately thought of the women at the Temple of Love and set the harlot called Shamat to travel with the trapper. After 3 days, the two of them reached the watering hole. They sat down and waited for the wild animals to come. For 2 days they waited. And on the third day, the herds appeared, and Enkidu was with them. "There he is," said the trapper. "Now, Shamat, have no shame, and welcome his love. When he comes near, uncover yourself and entice him. Teach him the ways of love." Shamat was a skilled priestess, and she was not ashamed, and she easily attracted Enkidu and welcomed his eagerness. They made love for 6 days and 7 nights, and Enkidu forgot about everything else. At last, he was satisfied, but now the gazelles bolted when he approached, as did all of the wild animals. Enkidu tried to run after them as he had in the past, but his swiftness was gone. He was weak. Weak, but also wise. And now he thought like a man. So we went back to Shamat, and he sat at her feet. "What do I do now?" he asked her. "The animals run away. My old life is gone." "You're a fine, strong man," Shamat said. "And now you are also wise. You don't want to run in the hills with the animals anymore. Come with me, and I will take you to the city of Uruk. You will excel at the ways of men, and you will meet Gilgamesh. He is also very strong, but he is like a wild bull, and although he is king, he does harm to people." Enkidu was very happy to have a companion who understood him. "Take me to Uruk and to Gilgamesh then," he said, "and I will challenge him. I will tell him that I am the strongest one here, and I will change the order of things." Shamat was glad to hear all of this, and she was very glad that Enkidu was willing to go with her. "You will find the city and the people very beautiful," she told him. "And I will show you Gilgamesh, man of many moods, and he will see your face. But stop your boasting, because he is stronger than you. The gods have favored him, and his body is perfect, and he has deep understanding. I tell you, Gilgamesh will know in his dreams that you are coming to Uruk." So Enkidu and Shamat left that place, and they joined up with some traveling shepherds. Enkidu learned to wear clothes, to eat human food, to pray, and to herd sheep. He even hunted the wolves and the lions, who had previously been his peers. Shamat gave him clothes, she gave him bread and wine. She introduced him to every practice that was necessary. And now when she looked at Enkidu, she said, "When I gaze on you, I now see a god." Meanwhile, Gilgamesh had a strange dream, and he went to tell his mother, Ninsun. "Mother," he said, "last night I had a most curious dream. I was in the company of young heroes, and I was full of joy. As I walked through the night, a star fell down, a meteor from the sky. I tried to lift it, but it was too heavy. All of the people of Uruk gathered to see and kiss it, and I myself was attracted and loved it like a woman. The people helped me, and I raised it, and I brought it to you. And you said that you had made it, and that the gods had given it to me as my brother." Ninsun was very wise. "This fallen star, this meteor," she said, "was made for you. This is the strong friend and comrade that you need. He is the strongest of wild creatures, and when you see him, you will be glad, and he will never forsake you. This is the meaning of the dream, my son. Well, Enkidu was happy with the shepherds, until one day he saw a man approaching. He was tired and weary, and Enkidu went to the man and asked him about his journey. "I am on my way to Uruk to attend a wedding," the man said. "But alas, Gilgamesh has shut up the marriage house, and he demands to be first, as he always does. The people have very heavy hearts indeed." Enkidu's face got white with rage. "I will challenge him," he said. "I will change things." And so he went to Uruk too. When Enkidu walked through the marketplace, a crowd gathered and followed behind him. "He's as big as Gilgamesh," some of them said. "Oh, I think he's a little bit shorter," said some others. "Oh, I think maybe he has heavier bones." The people followed along, whispering and speculating about who this strange wild man might be. And everyone rejoiced because, whatever the details, Gilgamesh had clearly met his match at last. At the marriage house, the bride was waiting for her groom, and the mighty Enkidu stood in the street. When Gilgamesh arrived, he blocked the way. But Gilgamesh, with a flicker of annoyance, brushed past him. Enkidu put out his foot. Gilgamesh stumbled, and the two men grappled. They started to wrestle and fight and snort like wild bulls. The walls of the surrounding building shook, until finally Gilgamesh threw Enkidu to the ground. He looked down at the hairy man. His anger subsided. "You are the one that was sent by the gods," he said. "And they have given you kingship because you are stronger than any man." Gilgamesh and Enkidu embraced, and thus their friendship was sealed. I'm going to stop there for today so that we can take a few minutes and consider these two characters, the semi-divine King Gilgamesh and his wild man companion, Enkidu. If you're familiar with the Iliad and the character of Achilles, you might recognize Homer's potential borrowing here of the situation of Gilgamesh. Achilles, like Gilgamesh, was part god and part mortal. And the upshot of this seems to be that despite the many gifts and talents, in particular a superhuman strength and courage, there is a particular type of loneliness. Because he is more than, Gilgamesh, like Achilles, has no peers. There's nobody for him to relate to, and the activities and demands and pleasures of ordinary human life can't satisfy him. Everything comes too easily, and there's no limits. Nobody can stop him. Gilgamesh is bored and perpetually casting about for something to do. There is nothing for him to push against or break himself against. And although we usually don't think about the obstacles in our lives this way, as being part of what makes life dynamic and interesting and worthwhile. The image of Gilgamesh shows us that this is the case. Now, I love the fact that the gods don't look down on the poor people and dismiss them. And I also love that the gods don't look down and see Gilgamesh and go, well, that was a bad experiment. Clearly, the two-thirds, one-third divine and human thing doesn't work. Let's just kill him. They easily could have done that because, of course, he is mortal. No, instead, Anu goes to Aruru and says, we've got to find a way to rectify this situation. And the answer is to bring Gilgamesh's tremendous power into balance. And how do they do that? They provide him with a limiting factor. Not a limiting factor in terms of hardship, but in a limiting factor that is a peer, that is a companion. Now, there are lots of people who read the story of Gilgamesh and Enkidu and see it as being kind of an allegory about the relationship between nature and natural, that is, wild humans and civilization. And there's something to that, but I think that that's also a rather simple view. If you ask yourself which of these two men, Gilgamesh or Enkidu, was the most civilized, that is, the most respectful of limits, the most community-minded, the most refined in his emotions, it was, in fact, Enkidu, wasn't it? We don't hear anything about Enkidu abusing anybody or using anyone, doing things indiscriminately because he's bored. It's interesting, don't you think, that even at this time, back 4,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, the Sumerians were telling a story that involved looking back. A story about a loss of innocence and a sense of purity in that wild, sort of pre-human, pre-civilized state of being. Enkidu could run with the animals. And there are many myths across cultures that postulate such a time. There is a longing for that kind of seamless integration between human and the rest of the natural world. There is also a universal longing for a lost golden age. Today we lament the loss of many things, and it's right that we do so. But I think it's also important to understand that it's part of our mythological heritage to be looking back. In fact, this may be one of the connections between myth and memory, our shared cultural human memory. We want to retain what we remember as good from the past. Good in the world and good in ourselves. You can think about this as a longing to return to childhood and our romantic views of childhood and childhood innocence. And yet, time marches on. We become civilized. We grow up. The world is papered over by layers of ideas and rules, by increasing sophistication and complexity and technology. This is our lived experience, and I'm suggesting that it may also be built into our myths and into our mythic consciousness. However, there is a need for both, right? Enkidu is still the wild man, as we will see. He has been brought into and learned the conventions of Gilgamesh's world, but he has not become another Gilgamesh. Enkidu will be the partner, not just the subject of this king, and his presence and friendship will refine Gilgamesh and bring out what is truly great in him. I mentioned my interest in other translations of Gilgamesh. I plan to start with After Gilgamesh, a verse play by Oxford poet and playwright Jenny Lewis. I'm going to share a YouTube link to one of her poems that she sets to music, and you'll find that along with the transcript of this episode on the Mythic Mojo website. Here are a few lines from the Jenny Lewis translation about the aftermath of Enkidu's liaison with Shamat, the temple prostitute who brings him to enthusiastic awareness of his identity as a male human being. Far away, under the forest's boughs, a small gazelle still searched for him in vain, and others sniffed the air to catch his scent. But there was nothing carried on the wind, and in his mind, no thought of them was left. And that's it for me, Catherine Savala and Myth Matters. Feel free to contact me if you have questions or comments about today's program. If you are new to Myth Matters, I invite you to head over to the Mythic Mojo website, where you will find information about the podcast and a variety of ways to subscribe or to listen from your favorite podcast platform. I also post transcripts of each episode on mythicmojo.com. I'm happy to announce that Myth Matters is now available on iHeartRadio and Alexa. Many thanks to those of you who are sharing this podcast with family and friends on all of these various platforms. And if you're listening to Myth Matters on a platform that allows you to leave reviews or ratings, please post one in support of this podcast. These are like breadcrumbs making a trail through the forest of information that inundates us, and it will help others who need the stories find Myth Matters. Myth Matters is listener-supported. If you are finding value in this podcast and are able to make a monthly contribution of $5 or $10 or $20 a month to support the production of Myth Matters, please do. It's super easy to find Myth Matters on Patreon and become a patron of the podcast. Once again, head over to my website at www.mythicmojo.com and click on the link to Patreon that you'll find on the homepage. If you are listening to Myth Matters on the Mojo website already, there's a button in the sidebar that will take you to Patreon. This week, I want to give a special thank you to longtime Myth Matters supporters, Paula and Luana Lynch. Thank you so much for your support of the podcast, for both your comments and your dollars. It feels really good to support something positive these days, especially work that fosters personal growth and community and the search for life-sustaining alternatives. On that note, I am seeing the power and the impact of many people making small moves together, and that's part of what is sustaining my optimism in these times. Thank you so much for listening. Please tune in next time. And until then, happy myth making, and keep the mystery in your life alive.